I do have one or two presentations still in the pipeline, but this is not confirmed yet. But otherwise, at that point, we are kind of through all the main lectures. So then you still have another week or 10 days to work on your coursework. Deadline, if I remember correctly, is
19th?
11th.
November 11th.
November.
Okay. And the exam is, I don't remember
either. 29th
November. Okay, right. Yeah, then you have plenty of time to prepare for the exam.
So
we're
looking at the 11th
November?
So yesterday there was no physical lecture, but we had some chat with some of the students who appeared regarding coursework. The others who have not showed up yesterday, I assume you have control about your coursework topic. You know what to do and what to come up with in terms of a proposal, a paragraph with a topic, and
I guess that's a quick question.
Okay. Just to finish that sentence. So the point is, you don't have to wait until
October 19th.
Exactly. So as sooner you have a topic and a paragraph and you get the green light to start with, go for it. Then you have more time to write the that's my point. Do not wait until the... Yes?
In the email I sent you when you responded, you said, like in that paragraph, to comment on the expected outcomes of the paper. What exactly do you mean by the expected outcome?
What can the reader take away from that paper?
Okay.
What are potential conclusions
from the paper we're writing? Right?
From the paper you're writing, yes. So one thing is a kind of the aim. What are you intended? So what is the intention in the paper? And what is the potential takeaway? Any other questions related to coursework? Otherwise, send an email, communicate. And do not wait too long.
Hello.
Hi, Chacha.
Hi. Yes.
What should we do?
I pulled out from my
you need some...
No, just...
Okay, good.
Have you met Chocho?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so very good.
Yeah, I was in the welcoming event in when they were just arrived.
Okay, very good. Yes, the talk today is about digitizing analog motion pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very, very good.
So. Okay. This is sort of the
one. As I used to say, it's all about contrast. So, so this helps. And perhaps don't sleep. Yeah, okay. Looks good. Yes, thanks.
You're welcome.
Very good. Okay.
So this is the plan? For this, it will be in two days. First is today, right? Okay. First is today. Digitizing motion picture films, and then in 3 weeks or so. No, exactly 3 weeks. Once the film is digitized. If it's faded, we can do something to digitally restore it. But today we will go first to the first step of this process, which is the digitization. I found, since you're a bit younger than me, for example, no, all of you maybe have handled a film, or probably all of you. This could be an interesting information. How many of you never ever handled a photographic film on celluloid? No. Okay, that's good. Yeah. Of course, you are in. In a
reality
to source. Yes, but still, I'm glad to hear that. Film is not dead. Maybe it's about to die. There is, of course, there are advantages in the in film, and you can very well understand. Imagine that our society all of a sudden collapses, and. After a while, so let's say there's no society anymore, there's no knowledge anymore, but humanity still manages to survive, and the new humans after this collapse, if they find a CD, for example, they would think it's a frisbee or some toy to do some light effects or. If they find a hard disk, it could be something that could be used to build a house, like bricks. If they find a film, even if it's motion picture, probably they easily understand what it is, how is it used, because the image is there, is in front of you, and this makes everything more human readable and therefore direct and understandable. I will be, let's say, the topics that most of the topics that I will talk about are valid for still photography and motion pictures because the materiality, the chemistry is very similar. Almost identical. Motion pictures has some additional problematics, mostly related to the fact that with the still photography, for example, if your light is low and your the film speed, the film is slow, meaning that you need a lot of light to capture an image, and you can open the shutter, wait as long as you like, and then close it. And if nothing moved, you have an image which is sharp and it's well exposed and it's good. If you are in motion pictures, you have a 24th of a second to do this, no matter what, if you want to have a smooth motion reproduced. So instead of continuing speaking, I decided to show you a video that gives you, in a very direct way, very easily, with nice images, an idea of what does a motion picture.
Now, here is a motion picture film, 1,000 feet, 16,000 separate photographs. Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel. Now, we'll build a projection machine to show the pictures on a screen. The film unwinds from the reel and rewinds onto another reel after it runs through the projector. To throw the picture on the screen, there is a bright light with a reflector behind it to send the light rays in the right direction and a lens to concentrate the light. The film passes a hole or aperture which lets the light go through only one picture at a time. There is another lens to focus the pictures on the screen. By adjusting the lenses, the picture can be made sharp and clear. Let's start the machine moving. The still pictures blur because they're moving all the time. And this won't do at all. We need something to hold each picture still long enough for us to look at it in between the changes. When the film is started and stopped in rapid succession, the eye sees the changes being made, and the result is streaks instead of movies. So we need a shutter to cut off the light while every change of picture is being made, and let light through only while the film is standing still. Surprising as it seems, you never see a motion picture while it is actually moving. The only time a movie moves is when the shutter keeps you from seeing the change of picture. Then we see it just the way it looks in real life.
So, so the picture, motion pictures, but basically the picture doesn't move. So if this is the picture, as I always like to say, if this is a picture, a motion picture is this one. But the real motion picture doesn't move, because even when it moves, it has to be invisible. I don't know if you noticed that at the very end of the video, in the end, the picture was, let's say, the shutter was closed when the frame was moving, but still you could see the flicker at the very end. And then the speaker said, and then the picture is there, and everything is beautiful. There was one part missing, which is a rather important thing of motion pictures that I think I will not speak about later. So it's the proper moment to talk about that. This shutter actually closes three times per frame, meaning that it shows first frame one once, and then closes frame one again, second time, and closes. Frame one again, third time, and then it closes. And while it closes, now it goes to frame two. And then opens, frame two once, then closes, frame two again, and so on. This is because our Flickr threshold, let's say the frequency at which the Flickr is not visible anymore, and we see basically a steady image, is higher than what we need to see a smooth movement. Therefore, when they started designing this technology, they decided instead of doing 72 frames per second, they decided to save film and use 24 frames per second because it was enough to have a smooth movement, but triple the flicker in a way that then both the movement is smooth and the flicker is invisible. This is a little bit of history of what is going on, what has been going on in the history technology of motion picture film, especially about color. And
George, I do have a question about the flickering. Is the flickering independent of the content of the image? In the sense that if you have a high frequency image, a lot of details versus kind of huge area, very smooth area, sky,
yeah.
And green glass.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the difference.
Yes, yes.
In the detection.
Yes. If a lot is going on visually, and there are two factors. If a lot is going on, you are less sensitive to the flicker, so your threshold is lower. The flicker fusion is a lower frequency. And there's another factor also, which is the brightness. Of course, is the jumps. Is we're talking about on and off, no? If the brightness of the on is very high, then your flicker fusion will be higher, because this bigger jump needs a higher frequency to disappear. So if you, for example, even with the three blades projector, if you remove the film and you just shine the light without film, which is fulfill both the requirements for the needing a higher frequency, because it's perfectly homogeneous and very bright because there's nothing absorbed, in that case you see the flicker, even at 72 hertz, which is supposed to be above the flicker field. Yeah. So here you can see that basically there was an experimental time in the first half of the 20th century. And then starting from the 30s, but completed in the 50s, at the beginning of the 50s, there was a sort of standardization. The experimental time had a lot of inventions, a lot of failures, a lot of good ideas, bad ideas, and all sorts of mirabilia about temporal reproduction of colors, additive solutions, and then subtractive solution, which was already understood that for film was the best way to create colors, but initially with two colors because they were not able yet to do three colors reproduction, but finally the three color subtractive system was the successful method for motion pictures. Black and white always had its fascination, so sort of never died, faded away very slowly, but never completely died. Disappear. Let's not be dramatic. One example is was at the beginning, the, let's say, the colors before the color, meaning that the colors, in some cases, were not photochemical capture of the reality, but were colors that were applied on the film after development. In these two cases, mostly to evoke some feelings of fear, of calm, of whatever the filmmaker wanted to convey, using colors that were useful for this. Tinting is basically just dipping the film in a dye bath that tints the gelatin, the emulsion, and therefore the the colors are also mostly, you can see them at the edges and then in the highlights. Toning is a very different thing. It's a chemical reaction that transforms the silver, the metallic silver of the black and white image, into a salt that has a certain color. So in this case are the darks that are colored while the highlights are still white. So before, another important part, aspect of motion picture was the negative-positive process. So only the those methods that allowed the negative-positive process. That sounds like a complication because you shoot something, but the first product you get is something that is not usable as it is. So you need a further process to finally have the result. But these complications, as we will see, it was actually an advantage, especially for the professional filmmaking. This is the basic of any photographic process, both on color and in black and white. The first most important part at the beginning of everything is this reaction, in which you have a silver highlight, a silver salt, which is, so you can imagine that the salt is transparent. And when this is hit by a photon, in combination with the developer, the salt becomes metallic silver. And metallic silver is opaque, is black. So basically you have light produces darkness, which is, in the end, you get an image in which everything is inversed. But then you can do this process again. For example, in this case, this is an example of printing on paper with an enlarger in a schematic way of a still photograph. But you can understand what is the advantage. You have a matrix, you have a negative, and from that thing, you can do as many prints as you like. And especially if you want to distribute things, if you that is a very big advantage. And jumping a bit back and forth. Sorry for that. I just wanted to show you also some spectra and color spaces because you all have to be familiar with this type of plots at the color lab. For example, the toning, which we saw before, as I said, is a process that produces a result in which the darks are colored and the highlights are colorless. And you can see this quite well here in this. Spectral density means absorbance, means how much the film absorbs, and we can see that in the lower part, of course, we have the highlights, and in the top parts we have the darks, and you have basically this flat land that slowly grows and has this heel at the top. And of course, color is always something when you have some selective absorption in different parts of the visual spectral range. And in this case, the locus of the colors produced with this system is a longer line, like you see here in this plot. So we have, let's say, a monodimensional variation. This is another funny example. Nice to see. It's not photographic, it's a drawing, but still it's color on film. So you can also have other types of solutions on film. This is chromolithography, little loops. These were used for kids, for mostly entertaining kids, probably of rich families, because they could only afford such a thing. Here, of course, you can have all sorts of colors, whatever you like. The artist, the filmmaker, let's call it like this, was choosing the colors. And these colors, even if they are not natural, I mean, they are not captured photochemically, and they are applied, but still they want to refer to reality in a way that skin tones are pinkish and the rest is in accordance to reality, but still, which was not the case for tinting and toning. But of course, will be the case from now on with all the processes that try to find a photochemical solution to capture the actual colors of the scenes. These were, for example, some additive systems. This example is CineColor in the cinema version, autochrome in the still photography version, developed by the Lumière brothers. With the autochrome was way more successful than the CineColor. You can see here that now with three primaries you have an actual volume, so not just a line, like in toning. and also interesting to see that this microscopic pattern of colors resembles the retina. And so it was very, quite similar. They were probably inspired by the studies about how the visual system is made, and tried to replicate this on film. But here the problems about the low film speed at that time limited a lot the cinematic version. So the Lumière brothers, of course, were very successful on many fronts, inventing cinema, first of all, and then also with the autochrome, one of the first technologies to reproduce natural colors, but not as much successful in the color reproduction in motion. Another more successful, we can see also this by the amount of time, just few years, from the 28 to the beginning of the 30s. So this Dufay color had a longer life because it was more effective in reproducing the colors. Because one of the problems of the autochrome was that red, green, blue dots were placed randomly. And this emotion was annoyingly jumping color, like a sort of color noise that was not very, very pleasant to be seen. In this case, of course, there was the approach was different, but everything was very regular. So this noise was not there anymore. And this reminds another important element of color imaging, which is the Bayer filter, color filter array, the Bayer matrix. But here, of course, we are many years before the appearance of this technology. Still, you can very well see that the color gamut is quite limited. And this, again, it's like saturation and film speed that are kind of fighting. So if you have low film speed, you cannot be very selective in the spectral characteristic of red, green, and blue primaries, because if you shrink the sensitivities of each of the primaries, then you get less light. And if your film is not fast enough, then in motion you don't have enough time to expose the film. So you have to broaden that's the reason why that green is not really green, it's more a cyan, which is very close to the blue in a way that closes that triangle. This because the sensitivity of the green had to be broader to capture more light and finally have enough exposure in the 24th of a second that was available. Another couple of interesting examples of now we are in the subtractive processes. It's very, let's say, understanding what is additive and what is subtractive, it takes time. And of course, everybody knows additive RGB, subtractive CMY. But it depends, let's say, if we compare these processes, basically, it is subtractive, you might think, because there is white light, and then this is subtracted, is absorbed by these elements. But then what happens? That once the light leaves the projector, is already divided in three components. And then the additivity comes from the fact that you're distant enough that these three components are actually fusing, because you don't resolve them. And then you have to imagine that in this case, a white, if you have a white point with this technology, anyway, what passes through is just 1/3, because in the blue part, you have 1/3 of the spectral range, the green part another third, and in the red part another third. So the efficiency is way lower, because if you have a subtractive system, which is a series of layers, if none of them absorbs anything, the whole light passes through. So you have, let's say, for a white, the 100% of the energy of your light source reaches the screen. And so this basically was the main reason why finally the subtractive system were successful for film. So these are two attempts of two-color subtractive systems with different dyes. You can see them here dancing. The one on the left, Kodachrome two colors. You have all these names that are used then during different decades for different products. Kodachrome was used also for maybe a couple of other products after this. So you have a green that modulates the long and the short wavelengths, and then a red one that modulates the central wavelengths. And in the multicolor is more divided in two, the spectral visual spectral range. This cyan dye that modulates the long wavelengths, and the orangish red dye that modulates the short wavelengths. And in this case, the locus is not a line like we saw in the toning case. It's not a volume like we saw for the additive processes that had three primaries. But in this case, you have two primaries, so it's a surface. It's a curtain, sort of. You can also see them rotating, so you understand better how they look like. And then finally, the standardization was talking about. So this is, I would say, is the first example, the very glorious Technicolor that had a very long life and dominated the market until the 50s, so for two good decades. So you have cyan, magenta, yellow, and this in case of Technicolor, it was a sort of a printing. So there was this at the beginning, there was this very bulky camera which was something like this, with three film strips that were used to capture the image, the three components, with a beam splitter that would send the image of the scene to the three different films. And then these were processed in a way that then finally the image of the yellow, magenta, and cyan were printed in succession on the same frame to finally have the color picture. This is not technicolor print. This is a chromogenic film, but anyway, the principle is the same. You have finally this three color subtractive system. That means you have yellow that modulates the short wavelengths, magenta that modulates the central mid wavelengths, and cyan that modulates the long wavelengths. And finally, the color space is really bigger. And at that point, you could really reproduce color in a way that was never possible before, at least in motion. So just to tell a bit of something that I will use later to describe some plots. We always deal with these absorbances, transmittances. What is absorbance and what is transmittance? You might have already heard this more than once, but just very briefly, you have your incident intensity, light intensity. This passes through a layer of absorbing material, red in this case. Of course, there's also a different refractive index, so you also have a deviation of the ray. But here we are not focusing on the deviation, we are focusing more on the absorption. And then you have a ray that gets out of the layer, and the ratio between what comes out and what hit the layer gives you the transmittance that you can express in percentage by multiplying by 100. And for example, in this case, you can have a plot that looks like this. So this green area, so the mid wavelengths are absorbed a lot. The long wavelengths are passing through. You have also a little bit of short wavelengths, and your final color is this very deep red. Then the spectral density or absorbance are the same thing. So basically, it's there's a logarithm base 10 with a minus. Basically, the spectrum is flipped because now we are expressing we are not expressing the transparency, but we are expressing the opacity, and therefore the plot is flipped, but it expresses the same thing. But also the shape is a little bit different because it's not only an inversion, a simple inversion, but there's also a logarithm in place. So for this specific film, now we can see the plots of the analytical and integral densities. Analytical densities are the single absorption of the single layers, something that you cannot really measure when you measure the absorbance or the transmittance of a field, you measure the integral density. So the sum of the absorbances that are taking place in the first, second, and third layer. But underneath, there are these three different absorbances at different layers. For this white point, none of the dyes absorb much, and therefore your integral density is very low, and you have your white. In case all of three of them absorb quite a lot, like in this case, imagine that three, optical density three, means 1,000th of light passing through. Optical density 2 means 1/100th of light. So it's a lot of absorption. So in this case, all three absorb a lot, and your integral density is this one that represents this black here. In case of red, you have no cyan. And this now it's important always to relate between additive colors and subtractive colors. So red means lack of cyan. So the other two, yellow and magenta, are absorbing a lot, but there's no cyan. And therefore, your spectrum is this one, and the final result is red. In case of blue, it's not yellow. So you have a little bit of magenta in this case, and a lot of cyan, and no yellow. This is your final spectrum that looks blue. And green is lack of magenta. So you have a lot of quite a lot of yellow and quite a lot of cyan and no magenta, the result is green. So, digitization. So now we have this, we understood this, and we had a little bit of history of technology, and we understood how more or less the film works. If you want to capture this with a digital imaging system, you need basically these elements, right? You need a light source that illuminates your object, and then you need optical elements. These optical elements can be used, there can be non-imaging optical elements or imaging optical elements. When I say non-imaging optical elements, I mean that the illumination, you might want to shape the illumination in a way that hits the film in a specific way, like concentrating the light where the film is. And then the imaging optical elements is the lens that then creates the image of the film onto a sensor. And then this sensor is something that transforms the light of that hit the chip in a charge, electrical charge. And then this electrical charge is transformed by the electronics in voltage, and then finally in bits. And then these bits have to be handled by a software that finally does some things and puts everything in a file that can be stored on our computers, and we can visualize it if as we want. But this could be a practical example. You have your light source and the diffuser, which could be a non-imaging optical element that just diffuses the light in a way that makes the light very homogeneous and soft. Then our film, the imaging part, the imaging lens, that creates the image of the film, as I was saying, exactly here, where the sensor is, and then the electronics will be somewhere here. This is the sensitivity of the sensor, of the CCD, for example. So you get an image that is black and white. And so you know enough to capture colors. This is the classic approach to capture colors. So you put a filter in front of each pixel of the sensor. I mean, this is a typical arrangement of Bayer matrix. And you get these, with these sensitivities, they overlap quite a lot. They want to mimic more or less the way we perceive colors. And but this is not necessarily the right thing, the right sensitivities for photography and motion pictures, and I will tell you later why. Then another approach could be to successively capture the images, red, green, and blue, with a different approach, because of course Bayer array and digital photography with the color chip is meant for photography, is meant for things that are moving, so you want to capture in a snapshot your scene. But in this case, you can move your film, have it steady, and capture as many images you want while the film is staying still. So you can adopt, for example, this solution. And in this case, the RGB emission of the LEDs can be very different. For example, can be like this. So narrow band with no overlap, not only with no overlap, like in this case, in which the three RGB sensitivities are overlapping, but also with a gap that can be dangerous in some cases. But anyway, this type of capture can be useful in some other cases. Then, of course, there can be other solutions with beam splitters, in which you can capture in a snapshot three images at the same time. But I just wanted you to focus on these two types of color image capture. Again, in case you have a negative, you capture the image of the negative with, but you're not interested in the accuracy of the colors of your image capture of the orange of the negative. What is interesting for you is that finally you get a positive final image that it looks good. So let's say having an accurate capture of the colors of the negative might not necessarily be a good idea, because again, what you're interested in is the accuracy of the final product, which is something else. So to go a little bit deeper in this in this topic, I always use this this way of drawing these sensitivities upside down, So in the way that you imagine that they are sort of buckets. So these buckets are collecting the light that is dropping from the top. And when you are considering a film, you consider the dyes that basically are responsible for how much water is filling this bucket. And you can numerically, basically, assess how much each of the three dyes contributes to the image formation of the red, green, and blue capture. So you have these liquids that fell in the bucket according to the how deep the bucket was for that specific spectral position. And of course, you in this case you can very well see that okay, there's in the red bucket there's mostly cyan, but there's also the side absorptions of the other two colors, and the same for the others. Meaning that here there's mostly yellow, but there's also a lot of magenta. And this might be a problem in some cases. Because then, in the end, everything is mixed. It's not that you can separate things. If you choose these narrow bands, you are more selective. And so there's way more cyan in the red bucket, and so on, way more magenta in the green one, and way more yellow in the blue one than the corresponding pollutions. Let's call it like this. This is called color separation. So you have high color separation. That means that the image the color information that you extracted from the film is higher. This, for example, is very advantageous for fading, which is another example in which, okay, I'm capturing the colors of my film, which is faded, to then do a digital restoration afterwards. So in this case, I'm not interested in accurate colors of my capture. Again, I'm interested in having a final result, which is what I want. And again, an accurate capture of the magenta tone of this print is not necessarily the good idea. This is an example I made of a digital restoration of this scene, starting from a capture with a high color separation on the left, and starting from an image with a low color separation on the right, for example, with a normal DSLR, with the overlapping sensitivities of the three sensitivities. You can very well see that if you start from the high color separation, you extracted more color information, so what you can finally get from your digital restoration is way more effective. There is a risk also with this narrow RGB, as I said. For example, this RGB was developed thinking of the CMY, three color subtractive systems, and because the film scanners were mostly born in the time of the digital intermediate. So when the digital tools started to enter the market in the 90s, basically, all films were still shot on film, but then you were digitizing the film, and then you were doing all the special effects and editing in digital. And then at that time also the cinemas were still analog. So the final product was written digitally on a film, on an analog film, and then the analog film was processed and then sent to the cinemas. This is called digital intermediate. And I just want to say that the all these film scanners were conceived to perform well in this type of work. So not to for what we call archiving scanners, so scanners that are digitize historical film and they want to digitize them in an accurate way, but to scan camera negatives of the 90s, which were, of course, cyan, magenta, yellow based. So if you have now some old film which has which was tinted and was tinted with this blue-green tint that has the absorption here, exactly in the gap between green and red, you basically miss the color. And it's like the scanner is colorblind. For this reason, now let's say, now we switch a bit to non-commercial product and things that we are doing here at the Color Lab, exploring also multispectral approaches. For this reason, we developed a multispectral imaging system for film digitization. This multispectral imaging system was conceived in a way that, okay, we have two possible approaches. Either we want to capture the colors as they are in an accurate way, and in that case we would go multispectral, or we can use just three of the, in this case, 10 multispectral bands of the system, and then do the RGB capture, which is advantageous in case of fading, is advantageous in case of negative CMY films. So we have both options. This was a bit the idea. So in one of the labs downstairs, there is this system which is based on this integrating sphere that has all these LEDs around that are shining in succession. And since we needed a common point for all the LEDs, to have, let's say, the same geometry for all the bands, we had this idea of this using this sphere, which was 3D printed here at the S building. And basically, all these LEDs, they have this common exit point. The internal part of the sphere is coated with a Lambertian white reflector, reflective coating, in a way that the efficiency is good, and out of this sphere from the single exit comes the light of all the LEDs. then there are this condenser. There is a second condenser here that basically reproduces the geometry of illumination of a film projector. And this was important because some colors have different appearances if they are illuminated in condensed or diffuse illumination. The diffuse illumination was created simply by inserting this diffuser very close to the film, which is here. And this is the lens and the camera here. If anybody of you is curious, we will do some work soon with this system, and you can see it in action. In the end, what digitization wants to do, the goal of a film motion picture digitization is to basically have a match between the perception of the image with the analog projector and the perception of the same image after digitization with digital projection in the same, let's say, at least in the same type of setting, which could be, for example, this one. If you have behind you an analog projector and a digital projector, if you project with the digital projection your digitization, you will see the same image that you see if you project the film itself that you digitize with the analog one. When I was in Zurich before moving to Norway, we did this type of experiments. You can see here, this is a curtain that has the proper width. The digital and analog projectors are back there, here in a separate projection booth, and basically half of the digital projection is covered by the curtain. Half of the analog projector is also covered here by this part of the curtain, so that at the end on the screen you basically have this cut between the analog and digital projection, and by sliding the curtain you could slide the cut here on the screen in a way that you could compare and you could have a feeling of what the results of our approach. To do this, of course, you have to do a lot of things. It's not really straightforward. First of all, you have to measure the illumination of the analog projector, because then your color calculations will have to be done with the spectral power distribution of the analog projector in a way that you get a match. Of course, Sava Sandir, you have to calibrate the digital projector. This is a Xenon Arc digital projector with DLP technology. Digital light processing is a lot used in cinema projectors. This, I believe, is LCD, but in cinema projectors, mostly you have DLP technology. So you measure red, green, and blue primaries, and white and black level, and these for cinema projectors is considered to be enough because the linearity of the system is rather good. So you don't need, I don't know, probably in some, you already talked about display calibration, with which you you measure a lot of patches. You sampled the RGB space with many, let's say, not only the three primaries and the white and the black, but many more points, because you have to compensate for the non-linearities of displays that are higher than in the projector, cinema projector, high-end cinema projector. And then you will, with the illuminant that you consider for the analog projection, you multispectral image, and then you have to use the classic color matching functions to do the summations, and finally you get what is called the three stimulus. The three stimulus, and this should be the same stimulus of the analog projection.
So the analog was a kind of the reference, I suppose.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And then with the digital, the kind of you simulated reference.
Yeah.
Using any kind of color encoding or or ICC or something else.
ICC is not used in motion pictures. Mostly used in photography, and but in digital cinema is not used. Of course, that's the same concept, but with another other standards. And then with you choose a destination color space, because finally you need RGB. Not necessarily. You can. There are also ways to use directly XYZ values, but finally the RGB an RGB image is often needed in many cases, in the majority of cases, because all our computers think RGB. So you need a destination color space, and so this destination color space that you choose, RGB space, determines the values of this 3x3 matrix, and then you obtain a linear RGB. You have to apply the gamma afterwards, and then you get your RGB.
Is that familiar? Does it ring a bell? Cross media? Bingo?
Yes. Cool. Yeah. In this case, here, I just wanted to basically tell you a little bit more details about the process of this parallel analog digital projection. In that case, to avoid to have full control of the pipeline, instead of choosing a standard color space like Adobe RGB or sRGB or whatever standard color space, I actually measured the color space of the digital projector I was using, that one, and calculate my RGB images in that space, and in a way that no other processing was done, and because this other processing would have been done, let's say, not under my control, because it would have been done by the player, DaVinci Resolve, or that I was using to play the video. But then these software very often are very like encrypted, like black box. You don't know exactly what they do in the background. So the best thing for me was to set things in a way, do nothing, just bring my RGB out as they are. And then since they were sent to that digital projector, and the digital projector also was set in a way do nothing, just stream the RGBs as they are. The RGBs had to be calculated in the specific color space of the digital projector that I was using. Yeah.
May I also, did you also verify your setup, your simulation against the reference with verifying, also do some verification and do some measurement on the screen with telespectral radiometer, for instance?
Yeah.
You know, so that you have the reference, the analog red versus the digital red, and so objectively it was pretty.
Yeah, it was. It was a good match. Yeah,
okay.
It was a good match. Of course, not perfect. The sources of mismatch can be many. In many cases the result was almost below threshold of perceivable difference. But we also have to imagine that this is a very, very demanding test because you're putting things side by side in a way that any difference is in front of you. And of course, this is never the case in a normal setting, in which, of course, you can be more permissive. But it was an interesting experience to understand a lot of things of the analog film technology, digital imaging technologies, and then also illumination, optics, because the way the film is illuminated determines the final look. So, and if you digitize in illuminating the film in a way that is not the same as in the analog projection, then the risk is that you have a mismatch. Even if your colorimetry is spot on and your calibration is perfect, but then your geometry or illumination was different, so you get some mismatches. So, just to say, there are many things to take into consideration.
Because I assume that there is some metamerism going on.
Yeah, not to mention that.
So, even though, as you said, colorimetrically...
Like an intra-observer metamerism.
Yeah. So, even though colorimetrically you might end up with exactly the same numerical values.
Digital imaging system is not very much prone to interperson metamerism as much as the laser that I measured yesterday. Sorry, I didn't manage to include the measurements of the laser one. Yesterday I brought the students to the cinema here in Jevik, the Cinema Strand. So we watched some DCPs, some movies, and short movies, and we did the measurements of the laser projector, because you have to know that the Cinema Strand has, the very high and most advanced technology in terms of digital cinema projection, because they have this laser projector that has a way bigger gamut than this, which is a Xenon Arc projector. So it's very powerful in terms of the gamut of colors that it can reproduce. But to do this, the primaries, the RGB primaries that you see here, are very narrow because it's laser, so it's really spiky. But this emphasizes a lot the differences between us in the way we perceive colors. So there are way more mesmerism in problem.
Did you calculate the x, y coordinates, or is it almost correct 2020?
I still have to, but the laser projectors are cover what the standard space, the REC 2020, that is way bigger than the P3. There is the space corresponding to this xenon arc projector. So this is just a teaser also for next year, if you want to be in here, if you can follow my course, because in the third semester they will be all back here.
No, they can choose
between Finland and
come to here.
So if you want, you can visit the cinema and have a nice experience in the with the employee there. They're quite nice people. It was a nice experience to the projectionist and also an incentive to go to the cinema, because it's a great experience. I mean, as a normal visitor, I mean. All right. And all these, this EIP3, so the color space of a xenon arc projector is now this drone here with this triangle, meaning the DCIP3 is the standard, ideal space, but it was defined also based on the capabilities of the xenon arc digital projectors that you saw before, so they pretty well match a normal native space of a xenon arc projector matches quite well the DCIP3. You can see that with this technology, film is still winning above the digital projection, because you have a slice here, especially in cyan. In cyan blue colors that are outside the gamut of the P3, meaning that if you have a technicolor print, you have colors that cannot be reproduced with a xenon arc projector. What time is it? Yeah, you know, 35.
Oh, we have forgotten the break. It was so exciting. Nobody said anything, so.
Of course, we can already start with the second part, but if there are, of course, now is the time if there are.
Maybe. So, how long is the second part? If the second part is 45 minutes, then.
45? No, maybe a little bit more.
Because normally we have classes until 12:15 or
just till noon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that means we have another 25 minutes.
Mm-hmm. No, we can start, of course, with this part. We could probably will be longer, and
we can also then continue later on in 2 weeks.
Yeah, we can start now and then we continue.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Is that okay? You manage another 25 minutes?
Yes.
Should I ask some questions now, or like wait till the end?
Definitely.
So what you've been talking about mainly is like just the transferring from analog to digital. Do you work with like analog restoration? Because you know that's a phrase I hear a lot. I don't really understand what goes into that compared to just capturing exactly what's on the analog film.
Mm-hmm. Analog restoration, you mean cleaning the film and...
Is that done like, physically, with, you know, physically cleaning the film? Or
yes, yeah. Mostly it's about cleaning the film. Fixing some mechanical damages. Yeah, often the splices. So when the film is kind of glued together, they might break. So fixing the splices is another typical activity. Then generally, of course, it depends on the value of the film. If you want to project it, if it's allowed to project it again, you have to fix the perforation in a way that the film rolls well in the projector. But it's important to mention, and that's why, let's say, the second part is important, that if you the film is faded, there's nothing, no chemistry, no treatment that can be done to bring back the colors. And this is opens up the big issue of film fading, because it's irreversible. You can always slow it down, and nothing can be done in an analog way chemically. So therefore, yeah. But still, film archivists are doing a lot of work also physically on the film, but not me. Any other curiosity or?
I'm not really sure about the black and the projectors, because I know that, okay, it's about the contrast and everything, but even now here we can see the black frame here from the projector, and I don't know, is it like the very dim white light, or how do they do that, like produce the black on the curtain of the projector?
Yeah, very good questions, because it's... one of the main problems of digital projectors, but also in analog projection, the black level is always a problem. Now we would have to go a little bit in the technology, for example, in the more interesting. I can speak about analog and digital. There are some, let's say, in black and white, you can reach a very good black, because the metallic silver is the blackness, and of course you have something that is opaque, and of course there is it's a still granular, so it's not like a slab of silver that blocks completely the light, but still it's very highly absorbing. So the deepness of the darks of black and white silver-based film are very very good, let's say, very black. And then for dye-based systems, processes, there are some that are more performative than others. Kodachrome, for example, the a reversal film, you can easily go up to 4, optical density 4. And optical density 4 means 1/10,000th of light only passing through, which is very high. So between 3.5 and 4. With digital projection, it's not the case, because so you have a light trap in the projector, and because black is not turning off the light. No, the light is always there, it's shining, and then the parts that have to be black basically deviate the light somewhere where the light is trapped. But then, of course, this trap is not 100% efficient, so you have light that is circulating in the system, and stray light that finally is projected. So let's say these already inside the projector, meaning that these pixels are black, but there's this bar anyway. Now we don't. Here it is. Okay, I was not finding it. Yeah, here it is. This is directly coming from here. Then, of course, you have the other problems are related to the room. If now this is pure black, the whole image apart from this bar, but this is doesn't count much. Then, when you have an actual image with blacks and white, of course, the white part then is illuminating the whole room and is also hitting the black part. So on top of the fact that you don't have a pure black because of the projector, your pure black, your non-pure black is also washed out by the stray light in the room. So this is a second.
Now, if you would adapt to this scenario, then the contrast that you have on the whiteboard between where there is no projected black and the projected black is enormous.
Yeah. Yes.
This is far, far from black. You can see.
Yeah. Especially when everything is black. Yeah. This is. This is. Let's say.
This
is the most emphasized situation. Yeah. Of course, we have this big hole and there, but
it's a lot.
And that's also the reason why. So I told you about laser digital projectors and Xenon Arc digital projector. Then there's another chapter that might be the future of cinema, which is, okay, in the end, cinema was always this projection booth. So you're basically, there is a screen, and then at the other side of this very big theater, there is something that shines the image on the screen. And of course, somebody started saying, listen, but why just not as a big TV? And in that case, if your pixel is off, it's off. And so It's very expensive because if you want to have a big theater with that big TV, it's very expensive. But this is something that is growing. Some years ago, I would say people would say, "Ah, that's the future of cinema for sure." Basically, Samsung is the leader of this technology. It's called Onyx, and there are not many theaters in the world yet. There's one is Zurich, Seal City in Zurich. So I visited one of these. I watched the movie. A movie I even didn't like so much, but I wanted to see the technology. Lady Gaga. What was that? A Star is Born. And Deep Blacks. So everything is more, intense. In terms of color gamut, there's not much improvement in comparison to previous technologies. But in terms of contrast ratio, yes, a lot, a lot.
And you still were able to find the popcorns?
Yeah.
That's the reason.
Then there's another problem. There's another problem in sound. Because the line band, the screen, has tiny holes, because it has to be sound transparent, because the speakers are behind the screen, because you don't want to see your character there that speaks, and then you hear the sound that comes from the sides. You want to see you want to hear the sound coming exactly from where the person, the character is speaking. And therefore, the speakers are behind this, and the screen has this special structure. Again, if you come to next year to visit the cinema, you will also see this. That, of course, are very tiny. You don't see them from distance, but it's full of holes. And with these LED screens, this cannot be achieved in the same way. So there's much of the resistance against these LED-based cinemas is also due to this sound problem. Curiosity. Okay. So, the next topic, which will be mostly developed in three weeks. Is dye fading, which is a very big problem, mostly between the beginning of the standardization. Basically, we could say there was something in the 40s, already during World War II. Germans and Americans were not only fighting on the field with weapons, but were also fighting in finding the best solution to render colors and have an efficient way to reproduce color accurately for motion pictures, because they both understood that this is not a secondary thing. Of course, winning on the field was the most important thing, but also having a way to spread the image of the country broadly and therefore having the proper technology to do it was was very important. And ACFA was state-controlled by the propaganda ministry, and a lot of money was going in the development of ACFA in Germany. And the ACFA Holonoi was one of the first negative, was the first basically negative-positive process on a, what is called monopack, meaning not like Technicolor, that had three films on the, in the camera, but a single film, like in black and white, and you capture color in the same way. Then this was a big competitor of Technicolor, for obvious reason they didn't need three strips and a very gigantic camera. But then in the 50s came Ektachrome, and this was a game changer because also they managed to, at that point the war was also over, so they also managed to gain a lot of information from West Germany on how the technology could be improved, and the but all these processes of the beginning of the chromogenic time in the 40s and then in the 50s were not meant to be stable. There was not yet the idea, this film has to last. This film has to be shown, and then once it's shown, so the stability of was important to have, of course, long enough to be shown, but then what happens next was not that important. It was only later that in the 70s and in the 80s they started saying, well, but now if everything disappears, it's not nice, because imagine your hard disk with your photos that become slowly disappearing. Maybe instead of continuing here, I have another video that would be a nicer finale of this part. Let me see if I... Yeah.
But then, if there was no time and just a rush, you took the guys from the water much too early. And then, of course, nothing did happen in the first half year or year.
Yeah, but then...
But then after two or three years, suddenly you could see the transition and the kind of a change in the color. Whereas if you would have done a proper job and really wash out the chemistry, then it would sustain much, much longer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Bad processing is one of the causes of, of fading. Yeah. I have.
Yeah. Everything begins with the shot. But then you answer that the cut itself.
Oh.
Each shot.
Sorry, sorry.
Together.
Yeah. Wait.
Everything begins with the shot. But then you add to that the cut itself. Each shot coming together as one continuous moment. The size of the people and the objects in the frame as they relate to the moments in the story and the emotions of the characters. Add to that the movement of the camera creates a very different kind of sensation. Now you add color, and the color tells a story too. And then you get the sizes of the frame itself. But all of this painstaking work and this artistry, this development of the art form, it's all in danger. Film stocks are fragile, so it needs to be preserved and protected. And that's why we started the Film Foundation. We need to keep watch over it so that future generations will be able to trace this extraordinary century-long development of visual language right back to the very beginning.
Yeah, Martin Scorsese has been one of the most, of course, famous promoter of film preservation. And so, let's say, not that nobody before him was concerned about this, but he had the popularity to kind of bring the problem to a wider audience and therefore help the community, the scientific community, to find solutions and for this problem. Okay, I think we.
Yes. Any further questions right now, or you're on me? Good. Thanks, Chocho.
Welcome.
Very nice talk. And we meet you again in approximately two weeks.
3 weeks.
3 weeks from now. Okay, very good. Okay. And we meet again at 1:15. Yes. Good.
Then you are there, of course.
Okay, you don't have to, sure.
Also, I have to admit, it's a long time ago I used Antenu travel service, this Berg Hansen. But I remember previously that I checked somehow what flight I want to take and kind of an idea of a hotel, and then I asked them to do the booking, you know, and send me all the details and the confirmation.
So you because give you give your date?
Yeah, you say, okay, I checked this and this and this, can you verify that and can you do the booking? Because then you don't have to run around and this and that, you know, and also pay, you know, with your card to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of, it's a little bit more safe, I felt,
yeah.
And they do the part.
Yeah.
but you provide your preferences.
Yeah.
You could also say, can you book me a flight to Phoenix? But then you don't know with what they come up with.
Mm.
Because, you want to change perhaps in Europe and then go direct to Phoenix, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Because in the very beginning, I remember asking the travel agency, you know, then they just made a booking, which was a kind of the cheapest or whatsoever, and then you traveled, and the travel was awful, because, you know, I had to go to Pittsburgh, but then I flew over Pittsburgh somewhere west, and then back again, and then so that was the first and last time. I checked the flight myself, and then I asked the travel agency to do the booking based on my information.
Mm. Yeah. So now I will start the process, and now that you reminded me of Bergh Hansen, I will do it from there.
Because of what we could do, if we want to travel together, you know,
mm-hmm.
then either me or you could just ask for to do the booking, and then it's just to add two names.
Yeah.
You know, both for the flights and for the hotel, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Did you see those?
Even though I don't know exactly what to fill out, but...
So, basically,
yeah,
12 and 18. I don't know if... For example...
10:45, then we manage in the morning somehow to go to Muelf and...
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
And then that is 2014 Phoenix.
Phoenix, yeah. Of Saturday. Because I...
Yeah, okay.
To let you understand...
You changed then New York, isn't it?
New York. See, I have this short... Basically, my duty...
Is on Sunday.
Is on Sunday.
Okay. That means if you
which
fly...
Which before... Then the conference is mostly...
And I have a meeting here.
Okay.
Yeah. And then that's the conference starts on Tuesday, isn't it?
Yeah. And
here we go back.
Yeah.
Well, from the timing, it would be okay.
Mm-hmm. I even thought to stay a little extend, maybe, but then for me, better not.
No, not for me neither.
Okay,
that's okay.
Mm. So, Friday 18 would be in the morning.
That's 10:30 in Phoenix. That means 8:30, 7:30. Yeah, that's okay. And then we go back to New York, isn't it? And then
yeah.
New York.
I can
also
maybe pull it back. It's SAS, huh?
What's that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Is it something else?
Ah, blonde, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no. Lördag, fredag, färdig. Yeah, this one, because then is
this one, yeah, okay.
This one is even better, because this one better.
So is this all the way SAS, or is it
probably to New York is SAS, and then from New York is a different one.
American Airlines.
American Airlines, yeah. Well, that's probably there is, that's fine.
Yeah, you have a...
Yeah. Is enough.
Wow. Huh? Yeah, yeah. 3 hours and 30 and
yeah,
40.
Yeah, okay, okay. And then... back...
Back...
What was it? Half past
this one,
9:45.
No, this.
Two stops.
No,
we don't want to have two stops.
There are two stops.
Mm-hmm. Oops.
One. Yeah, but this is...
Yeah, but 6 o'clock in the morning, that's, you know, we have...
I believe that somebody did the booking.
Okay.
Because I remember there was... Yeah, two stops.
That's... that goes to Copenhagen.
Mm. Something changed because I remember I found
This
9:29, 8:25.
But 9:29, I could not see that.
Yeah,
9:29 is not there anymore. And that was also SAS, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I did everything here.
That is gone.
Fredag. Okay.
But then, should I check with Per Hansen?
Mm-hmm.
Then I could ask for the flight back.
Yeah.
Probably it has also to be SAS, isn't it? So you cannot fly to Phoenix with SAS and then with something else back, just to have one stop.
If that maybe they find they have more flexibility.
No, but should I give a try? And then I also should I add that hotel? Or, is it cheaper if we buy the hotel by ourselves, because then there is a CIC reference number? But if Berg Hansen is doing the booking, then they don't have this voucher or what it is.
Well,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we send them